This is an ABC podcast.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Good morning. What's happening at the CSIRO and should we care? Recently, we learned that our National Science Agency is still going ahead with plans to cut hundreds of jobs, even though it got hundreds of millions of dollars from the federal government recently, on top of its existing annual funding allocation of $1 billion. And today, there's reporting that a third of a small group of scientists who model how Australia will cope under different climate change scenarios are likely to be sacked, or they've been told that, 5 out of a group of 15. That's the reporting. CSIRO hasn't confirmed it. We've asked, but they declined to talk to us. We're still waiting on that detail. We're going to hear today from people who work with them who say this means Australia will no longer be seen as a credible contributor to international assessment of climate change. Does that matter to you? We want to see what's happening from people who work with this group of people, but I also want to ask you. It's hard to look through the windows and the doors of the CSIRO, but do you trust that the CSIRO is getting it right? They've said it's all about rejigging priorities. They need to take those jobs, take that money, put it in a different way. Does it worry you, or do you trust that the CSIRO is getting it right? It's our agency. And at the same time as we have these questions about our leading agency, we know we rely heavily on citizen scientists. I know that many of you listening are citizen volunteer scientists. Maybe that's you. Tell me about what you do out there. Are we relying too much on citizen scientists in Australia? Tell me your experiences and what you get out of it. But are we relying too much on you? We're going to be talking about the health of our scientific landscape overall with one of our favourite scientists, a bee expert, on this day of celebrating bees. Yes, it is called Bee Day. I think that's a problematic title, but let's all join in and give bees a buzz today. We talk grassroots science experience as we discuss our nation's science agency. Also this hour on Conversation Hour, do you ever think about hygiene when you go in and get a mani-pedi? Do you just assume your salon is safe? Tell me about any stories you've had when it comes to the hygiene and the health aspects of your salon. Would you feel confident enough asking about how and when they clean their instruments? Is that something that you insist on, or is it something that you squint and look away from? We're talking about this because of a recent spate of, frankly, gross experiences that people have had, women have had mostly overall. We want to see whether this is a problem, how we can prevent it. What do you do to make sure that you have chosen the right place, chosen the right people who have the right techniques? What are the questions you need to ask when it comes to hygiene in a salon? Also, a little later this hour, we will be meeting one of the wonderful SES volunteers as we celebrate, continue to celebrate the volunteers in our society this week. But next, what is happening at CSIRO and is it posing a risk to Australia's reputation in climate change?
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Neil, you've called in from Geelong. What would you want to say?
Yes, well, I was wanting to say that I think it's really the individual citizens' responsibility to do something about climate change and not the government. You know, we shouldn't be saying we're going to vote for this vote because they do climate change. It's up to the individual citizens to pull their finger out and do something at home by themselves, like put on solar panels or buy an electric vehicle, what you're doing with your electricity and so forth. Yeah. And so I don't see it as the government's responsibility. I think that people are trying to throw it back on the government where it's their responsibility to pull their finger out, you know.
We're talking about climate modelling. Isn't that something that we should also be making sure that our scientists are doing now, Noel?
I suppose you're talking about
the grassroots efforts that we need to make.
I think that what climate change about a 7-year-old could understand it. It's really not a matter of thinking about it anymore. It's just about doing some simple, straightforward and simple things. You don't need to be a genius scientist to work out that a car is in the present cars aren't environmentally friendly.
That we're going in the wrong direction. Noel, really interesting point, how important is climate modelling anyway? Thank you so much for calling and giving us your thoughts. Joining me now is Andy Hogg, who's a Professor of Ocean and Climate Modelling and the Director of Access NRI. And that is the modelling that is part of the group's work that we're talking about. As I said before, five of a group of 15 scientists work with this model, and they have been told, according to reports, that they are likely to lose their job, five of the 15. Why should we care? Andy Hogg, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Mary.
Tell us about ACCESS. What does it do and why is it important?
Well, so ACCESS is a global climate model, and what that means is it's able to predict the sorts of impacts we're going to see in future climate. And you know, I heard Neil's comment before that, you know, to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions, there's lots that individuals can do. But even if we start reducing now, there's still going to be things that we need to adapt to. And these climate models underpin all our efforts to understand what those future changes might be.
So to go to Noel's point, actually, Andy, others might be listening and agreeing with him, saying, look, isn't this a settled question? Why do we really need to have all of these models with all of these scenarios? Let's just go on and do something.
Yeah, so there are things that are settled. We know that the world is going to warm. Whether it warms by 1.5 or 2.5 degrees C depends on us, and it also depends a little bit on the climate system. But the things that we don't know is that going to cause more floods or more bushfires? What's the balance of rainfall over the Murray-Darling Basin? Do we know that? And actually, we don't know about that enough about that yet to be confident what the sign of rainfall change will be across the Murray-Darling Basin.
So it gets really granular.
Yeah, and I think the main point is that as we learn more and more about climate change and we observe what's happened, you know, in recent decades, we can incorporate that information into our models and produce better forecasts of future climate change. And that needs a continuous effort. It's not something that we can just say, oh, we're done now. Mm. We need, you know, the more information we have about what's going to hit us, the better we can prepare for it.
Okay. So this is the model that you work on with the CSIRO. We've seen this reporting today that five of the 15 scientists who work on this particular thing have been told they're likely to face a cut. CSIRO wouldn't confirm any job cuts with us. We did ask. It didn't say either that the reporting was wrong. But let me read something to you, Andy, in a statement that they did say. They said, the proposed changes sharpen our effort by reducing activity in selected areas, including atmospheric chemistry modelling, Indo-Pacific ocean dynamics and some operational support, so we can better align our climate portfolio with our future science priorities. They say their climate science capability will be retained. In your view, if five out of 15 jobs are lost in this team, what does that mean?
So just a caveat first. So the 5 out of 15 just comes from anecdotal evidence. That's not I haven't released the numbers, but this is from people who have been talking to us and told us that they've been informed they'll be impacted. Mm. So to make a climate model, you need two things. You need software engineers to do all the computing, and you need researchers to verify that the science is accurate. My organisation, Access NRI, does the software engineering, and so we support CSIRO to do this work. And CSIRO have the research scientists who are running the model and getting the output and understanding it. So that's we sort of work together with them on this. Mm-hmm. So I guess we're now at a stage where I think we're getting subcritical on the real core capability that CSIRO needs to be able to perform that work.
Subcritical on, yeah, what that means that 5 out of 15 is just simply too much in your view?
Yeah, I think 15 is probably too small already, but you take away five of those, and it really does affect our capacity to make these future projections and to understand what future climate we need to adapt to in Australia.
Do you believe, Andy Hogg, that it would endanger our reputation on the world stage, if not as well as our performance?
Yeah, I think it would. And a key point is that most of the agencies that do this type of modelling are based in the Northern Hemisphere. They don't really care about El Nino. They don't really care so much about the Indian Ocean. They don't care about the Southern Ocean. So as really the primary Southern Hemisphere climate science nation, we occupy a really special position. And I do think we're in danger of losing that. And we're in danger of being the only, of losing our status as the only Southern Hemisphere nation contributing to these major international climate projections.
Andy Hogg, thank you so much for explaining that modelling system to us today.
Thank you, Mary.
Andy Hogg is a Professor of Ocean and Climate Modelling and the Director of Access NRI. Someone else who works in this area with the CSIRO is Christian Jacob, who is Director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Weather of the 21st Century at Monash University. Thanks for joining us, Christian.
Thank you, and good morning to you, Mary, and all the listeners out there.
What did you... We hear that this is, as Andy said, anecdotal evidence that 5 out of the 15 of the group that you work with on modelling us have been told that they're likely to lose their job. Let's just put that as not yet settled. But if it were true, how do you feel about that?
Well, just like you've heard from Andy, this is getting to a point where a foundational capability that we really need in this country, and we need to have a sovereign capability to do this, is at the brink of collapse. It's that serious, I think. And just to bring it back to why everybody should care, I mean, we're talking about cost of living. We're talking about, being short of money on lots of things. Mm. One of the things, as Andy told you, we will have to do, so we will have to adapt to changes in the climate that are already baked in, right? Mm. Even if we stopped emitting today, we would still see serious changes. You can think of the sea level rising. The sea level rising is an abstract concept, and we completely understand that it's going to happen. But what we really need to know is, where is it going to happen? By how much will the sea level rise on the East Coast compared to the West Coast in particular regions? Because we need to protect ourselves from that. Now, if we get that wrong, if we get the predictions of that wrong, we will spend a lot of money in the wrong way, and we will, what's called, maladapt. We will adapt to the wrong predictions because the predictions weren't of the quality that we needed them to be. And that's the danger we are facing here.
Does 5 job losses out of a team of 15, if true, substantially endanger that?
Well, we need to look a little bit back in time. The 5 out of 15 is the end of a process that's now been going on for decades. When I talk to my friends, I talk about the game of Jenga, which a lot of your listeners will know. And you have the Jenga tower, and it's very solid. And then someone starts to take a piece away, and then someone takes another piece away. And initially, no one worries about it. The tower still sits there, and it looks a bit strange, but it's still stable. And then suddenly we're starting to remove pieces where the stability of the whole construct is endangered. And we've already done that for a while now, and now we're removing yet another piece. We can't say with certainty that the tower will collapse, but the chances of it happening are increasing every time we take another piece away.
You're listening to Christian Jacob, who's from Monash University. We are talking about reported job losses, particularly in a modelling program at the CSIRO. And I'm asking you, do you trust the CSIRO to be getting this right, or where do you think we are going in terms of the science of climate change in Australia? Christian, what do you feel will be the effect on Australia's reputation on the world stage?
Oh, this could have a very serious effect. I came to Australia 25 years ago, and Australia was one of the leading players in the process of climate modelling in the world. And it's, as I said, like with my Jenga tower example, it's been eroded piece by piece. And we are now approaching a point where Andy called it subcritical, where the whole building could collapse on us. And I think this is a real important point in our history. We got to get this right. We got to have also think of the geopolitics that's going on all around us. The community relies on information from other countries as well. Will that information still be available? We've seen cuts in other countries. We're seeing geopolitical tensions rising. I'm really worried that not only do we not contribute to the international community, but we can rely less on what we get back from that international community in the future as well.
Christian, you've been quoted in The Guardian as saying that you're angry and it means that you can't stand up in front of people and say we're giving the best information we can. That indicates a certain sort of personal investment in the health, as it were, of CSIRO?
Yes, I've been a model developer. So this is a very particular, somewhat niche science that we're doing, but it's creating foundations that we all rely on, and that's developing these models. It's not about running them. It's not about analyzing them. It's actually about making them better. And people who do this work, and I'm one of them, are very passionate about doing that. And for the last 20 to 30 years, we've become an endangered species with no endangered species to save us, endangered species program to save us.
That's the climate modelers are an endangered species, you say?
Yes.
Mm. Is this happening around the rest of the world then?
It's happening in other areas. I mean, you've seen what's happening in the US around climate science. And one of the areas that's particularly targeted there as well is the development and improvement and continuous work on climate models, which ultimately give us the predictions for the future. The situation is slightly better in Europe. There are some really new exciting developments going on there that the European Union invests heavily in. But overall, the developing of the models that we all rely on has always been sort of a back, because it's happening in the background, right? Mm. It's not very visible. So it's always been a very vulnerable area.
Yeah. Christian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Christian Jacob is Director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for the Weather of the 21st Century at Monash University, and beforehand was Andy Hogg, Director of Access, which is the modelling company there. Again, CSIRO has declined to join us today, and they wouldn't confirm whether the job cuts was true, but they didn't say the reporting was wrong. We did get a statement from the Science Minister, Tim Ayres, saying that the CSIRO is undergoing a process of reprioritisation to make sure its programs are aligned with national priorities. You've said this on text. Joe says the CSIRO has steadily been losing credibility since it started moving away from pure science and chasing profit. This Australia has destroyed our strong academic base and reputation over the years. CSIRO is vital to our and the world's knowledge, particularly to do with climate science. It's pathetic and it's reflected through our education system as well. And we heard from Noel earlier, who told us we should be taking it on as individuals, this business of climate change. And this says, Noel is only half right. Individuals should do everything they can to lessen their impact, but nothing will change until governments across the world regulate corporations who make massive profits, pillaging the world's resources. Tell me what you think of that. That's the high end, right? That's the National Science Agency. Very soon, we are going to be talking to one of our favourite experts, particularly a bee expert, because it is Bee Day, and we'll be talking about what people are doing in citizen science, maybe a little too much. Maybe we're relying a little too much on citizen science. And also, get ready for a really interesting segment a little later this hour. We're talking about the hygiene behind mani-pedis. Someone has texted in saying, I would like to have a pedicure, but I avoid them for fear of contracting a fungal infection or something else. What should we be looking for? What should we be asking when it comes to mani-pedis if we are venturing inside that salon? That's coming up a little bit later. But first, let's talk about the world of bees.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin
just bees and things and flowers. Just bees and things and flowers.
Just bees and things and flowers. That song is 50 years old by Roy Ayres, and it's a classic. I am ashamed to say it was Amber, my producer, who told me about it because she's groovy, I'm not. Anyway, you probably all know that. It's perfect for today. 50-year-old classic. It's been sampled more than 200 times. Still, this is all about bees. We are talking about bees. We're also talking about citizen science. My next guest is a native bee scientist leading work on Australian native bee and pollinator conservation strategy. She joins us on the problematically known Bee Day to talk about bees and also the citizen science projects that she is actually conducting at the moment. Thank you so much for joining me, Kit.
Always happy to chat with you about bees.
Tell me, you are actually known as the Bee Babette. To paint a picture for people, when I was looking up your biography, I just got more and more thrilled that I'd be talking to you. You are a circus performer, and you lean into making bees accessible and interesting to everybody. I love it.
Yes. I think I love the arts as well as the sciences, and you know, science is so important for providing us with the answers of how we can best conserve bees, but to make people learn, love, and be inspired to take action, that's where the arts comes in. So I love merging the two.
Before we go and talk about your citizen science project when it comes to bees, just wonder if you have any reflections on the first conversation we've had this hour about CSIRO, where we're heading when it comes to the scientific landscape in Australia. How do you think that's going? Is it properly balanced?
I think it's really terrible. I'm not going to try and make it, you know, honey coated.
I like it.
Keep with the bee puns. But we need way more investment in science, especially environmental conservation science. Like the recent federal budget, there was so limited spending in conservation science. And, you know, our ecosystems are so precious. We are known as a mega diverse country. We have biodiversity hotspots like Southwest Western Australia. Yet our government is just letting that all go to the waste. And whilst it's fantastic that we've got more and more people being interested in contributing to citizen science is, you know, only really useful if it's backed by science, if it's designed by scientists so that we can be gathering data in the correct way so that we can be analysing it properly. Mm. And, you know, the other, I guess, thing is that it seems like there's more and more interest in citizen science, but that relies a lot on volunteers. Mm. And it's in this sort of public mindset or, you know, societal mindset that conservation, it's not worth anything. It's just like a little side hobby, a passion project, but it is so important. And we really need way more investment in science and CSIRO, you know, they should be investing more in environmental sciences. As you mentioned at the start, I'm leading an Australian native bee and conservation strategy. And this strategy, it's not funded by government, it's not funded by the big bee charities, because sadly, when it comes to our native bees, there is very little investment. There's so much investment into the introduced European honeybee, which is important for crop pollination and honey production, of course. And there's varroa strategies and honeybee and pollination strategies, but there's nothing for native bees. And our native bees, they are declining, they're at risk of extinction, but the government just isn't interested in funding this work. So I was like, I'm not going to wait around. I'm just going to start a
How did you start it? Who's behind it? Did you get any financial support?
No financial support yet, but I've got a team of amazing scientists across the country, and we're working together to first review pollination strategies overseas. So there's lots of pollination strategies overseas. There's an International Promote Pollinators organisation, but the government has to be the one joining this. And yeah. I've emailed the government and they haven't even replied, which I guess is typical for the government. But yeah. There's,
so no native bee strategy, even though they're endangered.
And I guess one of the problems is that there's only three species that are listed as endangered. So there's no monitoring of native bees. There's so many problems, but that's what I want with this strategy, to identify both the problems and the solutions so that we can work together, everyone across the country, to better conserve our native bees.
1300 222 774. If you are a citizen scientist, maybe it's about bees, maybe it's another part of environmental science or anything else, let me know. 1300 222 774. I know you're out there. We have talked about volunteers. We're talking about volunteering this week, and it is so important, even though my guest, Dr. Kit Prendergast, who's the bee expert, is saying, shouldn't be relying on you as much, but tell me your stories. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. As you say, you are championing the native bee. Kit, I looked up this morning how many species of the native bees produce honey. Just to be a bit flippant for a moment, it's 11 out of more than 2,000 species that actually produce honey. Are we not looking at them because, you know, they're frankly bludgers? Have we got deadbeat bees in this country?
I wouldn't say they're bludgers. I'd just say that, yeah, I suppose as a society, especially Western society, tends to be very extractive in nature, and we value things if they can provide particular services to us. But that mindset is why we have a biodiversity crisis. And you know, we shouldn't value any, I suppose, human individual just for what services they can provide.
So do you really believe that my flippant remark is actually part of the basis of it being ignored?
I think it's the lack of, you know, honey production, also how they can't be managed like honeybees, which are like really a livestock species and pollinate the introduced crop species. So our native bees are much more like those sort of indigenous values, where we value things as part of that tapestry of life, those sort of intrinsic values, and that's really lacking in Western society.
Yeah. What do you think that people who are listening can do? They've got a balcony or a courtyard or a backyard. What are things that people can do to help, genuinely help native bees?
So that's the great thing about native bees, is that everyone can help, because native bees, they occur, if we have the right habitats for them, in urban areas. And for native bees, the best thing, if you're trying to create a garden for them in your own backyard, is native flowers, especially the Mataceae, which are like the gum trees, our iconic yukes. Many native bees specialize on them, same with native peas, but native flowers are so important, because our bees have co-evolved with our plants over hundreds of thousands of years. And we see that with, you know, our other wildlife, like koalas, they'll only eat eucalyptus leaves. Same with some of our native bees, they'll only forage on eucalyptus blossoms. So planting native Australian flowers. We also want to leave some patches of bare ground for our ground nesting bees, keep big old trees for our little tiny cavity nesting bees, reduce and ideally eliminate pesticide use, especially in your garden. You don't need to use sprays. And then at a sort of individual level that tackles global issues, reduce your climate change footprint. I know you're just talking about our climate change. And yes, we definitely need big corporations to take accountability, but everyday actions can be really powerful. Like one of the most powerful things you can do is reduce or eliminate meat in your diet. The livestock industry is the second biggest contribution to climate change emissions in Australia, and it's the biggest cause of habitat loss and land clearing. And obviously land clearing is the biggest threat to native bees and biodiversity. So, you know, individual everyday actions can make a huge difference as well.
Yeah, going back to Noel's point and when he called in, thank you so much, Kit, for joining us today, and happy Bee Day.
Happy V-Day as well.
That is Dr. Kit Prendergast, who is the Bee Babette, as she is known, native bee scientist, talking about our buzzy buddies, especially the native ones. They may not make honey, but they are beehiving. You are going to get puns from me today. Join me in my punnery. Tell me, do you agree with Kit? Are you trying to help the bees? And also, are you taking on that perspective that, you know, it's us, it's the individuals who need to be stepping up with climate change and all the governments and or CSIRO? Chris, you've called in from Bendigo. How are you going?
Hello there. Oh, I'm really glad to be following the bee discussion. I just wanted to say that CSIRO have always had to rejig their priorities. We have always just accepted that that's the case. But they sometimes get it wrong. And I listen to the Country Hour every day, living in the bush.
I can hear the cockies behind you, I think.
Yes, a lovely spot. Anyway, sometimes they get it wrong, and I want to just put in one where they got it wrong, and that's rabbit control.
Yep, CSIRO got it wrong, you're saying?
Yes, I am. Mm. They, some years ago, decided that they didn't need to be working on that, and they haven't been. And now we've got a rabbit plague in the bush like no other we've ever had, doing all sorts of destruction, not only to businesses like farmers, but also the community, like being able to play on sports fields safely.
It's still a problem, Chris?
Oh, yes, it's a Country Hour hot topic that probably city people have not heard much about. And so I just wanted to broaden it by saying sometimes they get it wrong, and I wonder how they set their priorities.
Yeah. Chris, that's a really interesting question. And when it came to that modelling project that we've been talking about today, they did say, look, it's all about getting the right priorities, but they didn't quite join all the dots as to why those job losses would lead to better priorities or what indeed those priorities were. Thank you, Chris. Thank you for joining us from beautiful, cocky-laden Bendigo there. John in North Victoria says the climate industry is a massive gravy train. It needs to be rationalised. And Pete from South Yarra says maintaining the access model is a sovereign capability issue. And presumably the staff work in shifts to do tasks, and it's laughable to think that 10 people are enough. As I say, all of this is yet to be confirmed. The CSIRO hasn't come forward with confirmation or denial. But thank you for joining us today. It seems like all of us on an individual level and a national level are super invested in not just the science, but the scientists who bring it to life and the bees we potentially are saving. It's 23 minutes to 12. I tell you what, we've also got some experts in hygiene, and very importantly, if you go to the salon, how much do you think of hygiene? There have been some really gross cases lately. My next guest can tell you what to look out for.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
Joining me now is Helen Banwell, Program Director for Podiatry at Adelaide University. Hi, Helen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
1300 222 774. If you'd like to hop on the line now and talk to Helen, maybe ask her a question about how you can make sure you don't come out of the salon with anything other than pretty nails. Helen will tell you all about the risk of infection from manicures and pedicures. 1300 222 774. What have been your experiences? What should you be asking for? Do you feel you can actually ask those questions? 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Helen, this was all sparked off by a spate of women in Perth who told the ABC they contracted severe infections after visiting nail salons. And the ABC stories had, you know, pictures of feet with covered in bandages. Didn't even see the gross stuff, but it made me wince.
Mm-hmm. It was quite disturbing stories that came out too. And, you know, some poor lady ended up with sepsis, which is a really life-threatening, situation from an infection that sparked off from a pedicure. And the trouble with pedicures and manicures is that they are a bit of a risk because they take sharp instruments to our skin. And, of course, as soon as you have something sharp near your skin, you can get nicks and cuts, and those nicks and cuts can very easily become infected. Unfortunately, if the infection isn't, you know, sort of stopped early in its tracks, you can end up with some fairly serious and, you know, consequences like these poor women did in Perth. Mm. So, going for your manicure and pedicure, as much as we love them, you know, who doesn't love a nice, polished, beautiful looking, you know, buffed foot or hand? But the reality is that there are some risks. And so, and there are things that you can do,
absolutely,
you know, to try and mitigate those risks.
Mm. 1300 222 774, if you've got a question for Helen about this, what do you do to make sure that you've chosen the right salon? As you say, Helen, let's get a zoom out a little, talk about the prevalence of this. Overall, do you think that we can trust that salons in Australia are usually pretty hygienic?
We actually don't know. And this is the problem. If we look at the evidence that's out there, there's been lots of testing for some reason in Poland. Poland were obviously very hot on this. And so we understand what the risks, well, not what the risks are, we understand the infection situation in Poland, because they've actually gone around and taken swabs of the surfaces in nail salons and worked out that, you know, 30% of, in fact, 70% of all surfaces that they tested had fungus.
Can I just pause there? 70% of all of the surfaces in Poland had fungus?
Had fungus on them. In actual fact, 100% of the tested surfaces had either fungus, bacteria or a virus sitting on them. So we know that they can be a little bit of a hive, because if you think about the amount of people that they have through a nail salon place, and also just the nature of the nail salon, that they use the electronic drills to buff our skin, which just releases a heap of skin cells into the air, and with any skin cell comes the bacteria from our natural flora, or our microbiome is the technical term for it, but the natural bacteria, virus and bugs that live on our skin, and so we've just released them into the air for the poor next person that's going to come along and sit down.
Helen Banwell is with you. She's Program Director for Podiatry at Adelaide University. Tell me about your experiences, maybe the questions you ask, the questions you've asked yourself before you choose your salon, 1300 222 774. So, Helen, you were saying there's no data here because we haven't got the monitoring, but do we have the regulation to help?
Actually, so there are guidelines for every state. So it's all very state-based, and every state has recommendations. And we all have public health acts where we have a responsibility as, business to ensure we don't make people sick. So there is guidelines that direct the service, but the actual industry itself is not regulated. So if, you know, as a podiatrist, if you come and see me and you have a concern about my infection control procedures, you report me to ARPRA, and ARPRA will do the investigation. That's missing in the beauty industry. So the only option we have is to contact our consumer-based agencies in every state. So in New South Wales, it's New South Wales Health. I'm assuming in Victoria, it will be Victorian Health. Here in South Australia, there's a human and consumer agency. And so we contact them and we can report them, but it's not regulated. So the actual industry itself can't be completely audited, and you can't have your individual technicians and businesses, imposed upon if they're not up to standard, as you can with health professionals. So it's a little bit of a grey area, and there's, it would be much easier if they were regulated.
But then again,
you can't regulate every industry. So,
even though we might assume that you can. 1300 222 774 is the number to call. I do have some questions on text, but I think the really important thing is to get your opinion on what we should be asking, what we should be checking, and how you check.
Exactly. So you really need to, look and ask. So if you're walking in there and you're spotting that the person that was sitting there before you, they've just gotten up, they're making gestures for you to take this seat, what you really want to be seeing is somebody cleaning thoroughly before you sit down. Remember, all of that dust has just gone into the air. It's going to land on surfaces. Do you really want to put your hands or feet where somebody else's hands and feet skin has just been shed? You want to make sure they're very, very clean. And then the next important bit is, what are the instruments, what are the state of the instruments that they're about to put on your feet that potentially may nick or cut your skin? Because they are using sharp instruments, and sharp instruments come with a risk. So are they in a nice single-use sterile bag that you can see there's a sterilizer in the background. You can ask about that sterilizer and you can be confident those instruments aren't transferring
something.
So,
Helen, you recommend that you essentially maybe scout out a bit? People walk in
Absolutely.
And just see what's happening?
Mm-hmm. Before you even sit in the chair, I want to make sure, you know, have a really good look around, make sure that they're cleaning, they're all wearing gloves and those gloves are new for each person. If you're going to have a pedicure, is there a lovely, nice, disposable bowl cover that's put in front of your eyes into the bowl before they fill it with water so you know nothing from the person before is going to transfer to your feet?
I guess people get a bit awkward about, asking questions in salons as well, don't they?
Absolutely. And that's why I think if you're going to be a regular manicure or pedicure person, find your salon and stick to your salon. You know, sort of put your, as I always say, put your big person pants on and go in there and ask the questions the first time, and then you can feel safe and confident about going again. Particularly if you've got health issues that are likely to leave you more susceptible to infection. You know, anybody who's slightly older or has a condition that affects their circulation or their ability to heal, you know, popping yourself in those high risk situations can be quite in the long term a little bit damaging to your health. So yeah.
Helen,
definitely worth
you.
Putting those big girl pants on.
Big girl pants on right now. Helen Banwell, thank you for helping us put them on when it comes to salons.
Thank you.
Helen Banwell is Program Director for Podiatry at Adelaide University. Caitlin, you've called in from Coburg. What did you want to say?
Hi, I've just been listening. I haven't heard everything because I called in. I'm an environmental health officer and we operate at local council level and we do regular inspections of nail salons.
Oh, right, on behalf of councils.
Correct that there's no regulation because it definitely is in Victoria.
Is it council by council, Caitlin?
No, it's state-based and I would say that every state does that.
And what do you find, Caitlin?
Oh, at the moment, everyone does do it a little bit differently. Each council interprets those guidelines differently.
Do you find some gross ones, though?
Cleanliness can be an issue sometimes at these ones.
But they're open to... Are these spot inspections?
They're registered with us and they get renewed every year and they need to pass their inspections before they get their registration renewed.
Caitlin, there'll be so many people who are listening who are so grateful that you are doing your job. Thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you.
This is on text, nail salons give me the ick, and someone says, do your own pedicures at home, and I'm a nurse, and for years I would never walk into one of those salons. No brainer. I reckon there'll be people who are very much in favour of manicures and pedicures and love their local salon. Give me a text, 0437 774 774. Hopefully we'll have time to talk to you. But it is 12 minutes to 12 and it is volunteer week. What sort of person spends Christmas Day standing in the rain helping strangers and says every minute is worth it? Well, you're going to meet her.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
This summer, as all summers are, was a really busy one for Victoria's SES volunteers. And behind all of those responses that we pretty much take for granted sometimes are those volunteers who are giving up nights and weekends and holidays. Danielle Stevenson has been volunteering with Malvern SES Unit for just over 3 years, has attended more than 55 jobs, clocked more than 150 operational hours. Now she's Deputy Controller of Community Engagement. And she says the role is much more than volunteering. And I'm so happy to have you in the studio and lovely to meet you, Danielle.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I love the story of what sparked your fascination with disasters. It's not the usual one. Tell us about it.
Yeah. So for me, and it might sound a little bit unusual for some people, but I've always had a passion for emergencies and disasters. It started actually when I was quite young and I heard about the story of Pompeii. Pompeii did it for me. A huge, huge explosion that happened there. And I got absolutely absorbed in that story. And from that, it just led to an interest that continued throughout my university studies for all areas of disasters and eventually led me to have the opportunity at SES.
That is fascinating. Are you, I don't know, wanting one day to go towards a volcano or something like that?
Yeah. Funnily, I still haven't seen a volcano erupt, so I'm waiting for my moment.
Yeah, that's right. It might be hard with Victorian SES in Melbourne, but still. You have said that you wanted to help. When was it that you realised that wasn't just an interest, something you wanted to live and do?
I think it was again, ever since I was younger, I never saw myself as this individual that go out and have my own kind of dreams in that way. I saw myself as a member of the community, and I wanted to uplift everyone with me along the way. Growing up, I never really saw too much representation either of women in the emergency space. I thought it was something that I would have to address when I'm older and I've done my career, retired, then I can enter that volunteer space and potentially have enough experience to be a member of the emergency services. But having the ability to do that earlier through SES is really what led me to throw myself into this area, have the opportunity to work with so many vast areas of the community and be a role model. So be a role model for the kids that, like I was, who was passionate about disasters, wanted to know more, get to be that person for them to provide that information. And in particularly for young girls as well. Like I said, I never saw a woman in kind of the emergency service leadership role growing up. So having the opportunity to be one now has been incredible.
Obviously not just passionate about disasters, as you put it, but passionate about people.
Yes.
You say that emergencies can reveal the best of humanity. Tell me a moment that encapsulated that for you.
Absolutely. So there's many of operational stories that I can share, but one that I do really like to think about is actually going back to a time during the storms that we had a couple of years ago here, and went out to a job, had a tree down on a car, which you might think it's actually, you know, a little bit of a simple job, but for that member of the community, it was a devastating point in their time. They'd just purchased that car. It was the first car that they had. Mm. They didn't know about the insurance process or anything. So being able to connect with them, being able to talk to them, walk them through the entire process and reflect back on what happened when I lost my car in the Dandenong storms, helping them with that was incredible. And it wasn't just a role that I got to play, but it was the entire team that I was out there for the day.
Did you see the effect that you had on them?
I did. I could see them go from a bit of this distressing state to calming, well, not really calming down, but just understanding the process they were going to, feeling a bit relieved that they had somebody in their corner during this time and that things were going to be okay.
Yeah.
That they're going to get through this. And yes, it's a little bit of a hiccup in the road, but there is a huge community around them that's going to turn up in those wee hours of the morning, help them through that process and be there for them afterwards as well.
Yeah. And you do all the things to prevent people being in distress, of course. You work with school groups and you've got community engagement. And you talk about a moment with a father and son that you overheard and that really touched you.
Yes, absolutely. So one of my roles at the unit as well is I'm a deputy controller for community engagement, which means I get to do an incredible amount of activities with the community, whether that's being out at, say, the F1 stand or running scout groups. So one of the things that we did earlier this year is I had a scout group along and we were teaching them about the importance of them being prepared and what they can do to make sure that they're ready anytime that an emergency comes along. And there was a dad coming to pick up his son after the scouts visit. And I just overheard them speaking about, oh, we're going to go home. We're going to make this emergency kit. We've got to make sure we have this and we have that. And don't forget that, Dad. And where do you have those documents, Dad? And that it was fantastic to hear because for me, I knew through that session, we kind of instilled this culture of preparedness and resilience at such a young age already. That's going to be taken back to that household and that's going to help that household be a bit more prepared. And hopefully they're going to be able to make the changes that they need to make around their home. So when a storm hits, they don't need us. But if they do, they know who to call.
You're listening to Danielle Stevenson, who's a Vic SES Malvern unit volunteer and obviously has done a lot more and is so inspirational. 1300 222 774. If you'd like to tell me about your close encounter with the wonderful Vic SES volunteers as well. You also talk about being trained in everything from swift water rescue to truck driver, air observation. Was there a point at which you sort of thought, I can't believe I'm doing this?
Oh, absolutely. the SES has been able to provide me with opportunities and skills development that I never thought it was even possible. Like if you told me, not even before I joined the unit, but even last year that, oh, you're going to get your truck license, be able to drive the rescue truck around, I'd be like, sorry, what? it's incredible. But having those skills, knowing that if someone got caught in swift water, I knew how to throw the ropes now and get out there and I have the confidence to do so, it's incredible.
Yeah. So you talked about the importance of being a role model. What would you say to any girls listening or parents of girls who might want to pass it on who might not be thinking about emergency services?
Absolutely. What I'd say is there's a role for everyone. It doesn't mean you have to be out there on the chainsaw wielding that around to cut a tree down. There is something that we can all do. But most importantly for the young girls, I want to just tell them and show them as well that we're just as capable. We can be out there, and if you want to wield that chainsaw, you can. You can go do it. If you want to drive that truck, you've got every right and place to be there just as much as everyone else. And I say that to the young girls. I say that to people retiring, thinking maybe it's not for them anymore. There's a role for everyone, and come along, give it a try. I'm definitely glad I did.
I am confident that the passion that you bring has been relayed. I'm sitting across from you. I want to go out in the truck. I want to go and do that thing. I'm doing. Danielle, thank you so much for your years of volunteering
My pleasure.
Talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Danielle Stevenson, Vic SES Malvern Unit Volunteer. We are celebrating volunteers, of course, this week. We've also been talking about pedicures and manicures and hygiene. I had a pedicure 2 years ago, got a fungal infection, still can't get rid of it. Have never been back for another, lesson learned. But this, I bring my own utensils with me for them to use for cleanliness and sterilisation. We can get infections even doing our own, and she keeps her own antibiotic as well. There we go. We can just DIY a little bit, take our own along. I have had a lot of fun in this conversation hour. Thank you so much for joining me today. You can listen to this all again by finding the Conversation Hour on the ABC Listen app. Also, write to me if you have any suggestions of stories we should cover, any episodes that you would like us to make. Let me know. You can write to me at conversationhour@abc.net.au. That is the email, conversation@abc.net.au. Thanks, as always, to Amber and to Richard. Have a great day. Take care, everyone, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow.